From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, British rock star Elvis Costello. We'll hear why he looked like a 1950s rocker on his first album cover, and we'll hear some of the stories behind his early demo recordings. His first records were produced by Nick Lowe, who's featured on bass on Costello's latest record. We'll feature a 1990 interview with Nick Lowe about his own songs, his singing, and his approach to production. Also, world music commentator Milo Miles wonders about some of the so-called world music being released. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is a very satisfying period for Elvis Costello fans. At the end of 1993, a box set reissue was released called 2.5 Years, featuring his first three albums, a live 1978 concert recording, and previously unissued home recordings. This year, he released a new album called Brutal Youth that reunited him with his band The Attractions. Nick Lowe, who produced Costello's first five albums, played bass on several tracks. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring interviews with Nick Lowe and Elvis Costello.
Now that your picture's in the paper being perfectly admired, you can have anyone that you have ever desired. All you gotta tell me now is why, why.
When Elvis Costello's first album, My Aim Is True, was released in 1977, it demanded your attention. Costello had punk's pent-up energy and a songwriter's gift for music and lyrics. Even his cover photo was intriguing. He had Presley's name, Buddy Holly's glasses, and the pose of a 1950s rocker. When I spoke with him in 1989, I asked him about that photo on his first album, and he told me his image in that photo was totally unplanned.
When I first started, I remember as doing that photo session. I had two jackets at this point. That's all I had, two jackets. You know, I was trying them on, and we did some shots with this tweed jacket. And that, even considering I was wearing horn rims, that seemed a little bit too serious. So I put on this other jacket, it was kind of a mohair jacket, and I said, "We're happening now." And I had my electric guitar, which we didn't have plugged in, so that immediately makes it kind of comical, I think all I remember is the photographer Keith Morris and my manager, both of them guzzling bottles of cider, which was our chosen drink because it was very cheap, sort of all going, go on, throw the funny legs, you know, do some of those rock and roll, but kind of as a send-up of that. You know? So contrary to the image of the intense, sort of furious young man that's often written about in such romantic terms by rock critics, we were having a joke at the expense of all that imagery. And people fail to see the gag, obviously, because you're frozen there for a moment, and it came to represent something else, because the music obviously wasn't humorous like that. It was aggressive, so there's a curious little inside story.
Elvis Costello recorded in 1989. Earlier this year, he joined us again on Fresh Air to talk about his latest CD, Brutal Youth, and his box set reissue. I asked him about his song Just About Glad, my favorite track on his recent CD, which we'll hear in a minute.
It's a funny song because it very nearly didn't make the record.
Why not? I like it a lot.
I do as well. But
I even like the expression Just About Glad.
Yeah, and likewise. I had a little difficulty finding, sometimes you make a track and when you play it on its own, it sounds just fine.
Uh-huh.
And then you try to find where you put it on the record, and that's less easy. It seems like every track you put it next to, it seems to make the track before sound slow or it sounds like just wrong in some way. And it took quite a long time until we found just the right place to stick it on the record. we're just about glad. I mean, the story is concerned with somebody. I mean, it certainly couldn't have been written by a 22-year-old. It's about somebody who meets an old acquaintance with whom he almost had an affair or some kind of scene. And all the time he's saying, oh, well, I'm just about glad we never did that. You know, we never did this. And really you get the feeling as the song goes on that he's secretly really sorry that it never happened, although the girl perhaps is deeply relieved.
Well, I like the song a lot. Why don't we hear it? This is Elvis Costello from his new album, Brutal Youth. The song is Just About Glad.
I'm just about glad that I knew you once, and it was more than just a passing acquaintance. I'm just about glad that it was a memory that doesn't need constant maintenance. There are a few things that I regret, but nothing that I need to forget. For all of the courage that you never had, I'm just about glad. Glad we didn't do that thing. Just about glad we didn't have that thing. Just about glad we didn't give it a try. Just about glad is that a tear in your eye. All the few times I rang and proposed, there was a man there, or so I suppose. The greatest lover that you ever had. I'm just about.
Elvis Costello from his new album, Brutal Youth. A recently Ryko Disc released a 4-CD box set of reissues of your early albums with previously unreleased tracks. And it's been very interesting for me to hear that because I hear things about your music that I had heard about before but never could really understand. For instance, I know that you'd said that you'd played at folk clubs and that you used to perform with just a guitar. I could never imagine that until I heard some of these home recordings with just you and a guitar. So I want to talk to you about some of those recordings. Can we go back to, I guess it was the 70s when you made them?
Yeah, it would have been about 1976 or maybe even 75. I don't really remember when I recorded them. They were really just my first demo tape that was recorded on it on anything decent. You know, you always have some kind of tape recorder. Of course, tape recorders then were like big bulky things and not the little convenient devices they are now. And, you know, you start to sound like very ancient when you talk like this, but it's the truth. And it was just recorded in my bedroom, and I sent those songs around. And now when I listen to them, I can understand why, you know, I wasn't immediately signed up. I don't think that's because they're necessarily terrible songs, but I think they're obviously they don't demand your attention in quite the same way as perhaps the songs on the first album proper do.
Well, let me stop you there, because one of the songs that you record, that you have a home recording of with just you and a guitar, is Mystery Dance, which is on your first recording.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, that's what I mean. You can see that I was obviously just on the verge of discovering, style is perhaps not the right word, because a lot of the songs are very different from one another, but more the attitude with which I could put the song over and hold people's attention. I'm very fond, in a slightly embarrassed way, about some of those very, very early songs, the more gentle ones, simply because, like any work by somebody, the very first things they do, you can really hear how you're trying to imitate such and such a singer and mm-hmm. how you're really trying to imitate such and such a songwriter. And, of course, by getting it slightly wrong, you're actually being original. But at the time, you don't realize, you know.
Right.
Whereas with Mystery Dance, obviously, that's a song which in itself is not wholly original musically, because it's a typical rock and roll structure. But it has that edge thing that obviously people responded to in the first album.
Well, you mentioned, you know, your attitude, that you were just forming your attitude on these early recordings. I think the attitude on the previously unreleased version of Mystery Dance and the kind of full rock band version of Mystery Dance is different. In the home recording, you sound like Mystery Dance is a song about sexual frustration, about not being able, not knowing how to do it. And in the version with just you and a guitar, you sound kind of ironic and confused. Mm. But in the band version, there's this incredible, like, pent-up frustration in it. And I think the attitudes are different.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say because I haven't really play them back, you know, consider them like that, I was just amazed that the tape had even survived. Because, you know, it is quite a while ago, and it was actually played on the radio. It was the very first thing of mine that was ever played anywhere on the radio, that tape. And there's a gentleman called Charlie Gillett who was had a small record label, and he's written some very good books about music, and is a passionate guy about music and has always championed all kinds of different musics. And he had a radio program on a local radio station, BBC radio station, but the local London station. And he occasionally played tapes that were sent in. And in fact, another tape I know he did play was like a demo version of Dire Straits when they were just sort of starting
right.
out.
Well, I want to play your home recording back-to-back with the version from your first album, My Aim Is True.
And let people be the judge.
Yeah, I like them both. This is Elvis Costello.
Romeo was restless, he was ready to kill. He jumped out the window cause he couldn't sit still. Juliet was waiting with the safety net and said, don't bury me cause I'm not dead yet. Why don't you tell me about the mystery dance? I wanna know about the mystery dance. Why don't you show me? Cause I tried and I'm still mystified. I can't do it anymore and I'm not satisfied. Romeo was restless, he was ready to kill. He jumped out the window cause he couldn't sit still. Juliet was waiting with a safety net. Said, don't bury me cause I'm not dead yet. Why don't you tell me about the mystery dance? I wanna know about the mystery dance. Why don't you show me? Cause I tried and I'm still mystified. I can't do it anymore and I'm not satisfied.
Well, two versions of Elvis Costello's Mystery Dance from his recent box set recording called 2.5 Years. Now, something else that was previously unreleased that's featured on this box set is Wave a White Flag, a song of yours that sounds to me like it almost has roots in like music hall type songs. This song is so kind of removed from the type of song you usually write, musically anyways.
Well, you know, one of my favorite writers then and still now was Randy Newman.
Mm-hmm.
And I really admired him and still do. And, you know, if you don't play the piano, it's extremely difficult to get that kind of
almost vaudevillian.
Yeah,
sound.
Well,
yeah.
It's kind of a ragtime style, you know, and the closest I could get to it was really in a couple of those songs. And I don't want to make too much of them because, I mean, obviously they are very early tunes, so they seem a little halting at times, you know, but that one definitely was because, I mean, sometimes Randy Newman around that time was writing songs where, you know, if people heard them at face value, they'd be deeply shocked by what they were saying until you realize he was being ironic, because irony isn't a quality which is, you know, it's not everybody's experience. And I would imagine that's what I was trying to do. Although, as I say, it's a little hard to remember now.
Well, let's hear Wave a White Flag, and this is one of the previously unreleased recordings on the Elvis Costello box set 2.5 Years, a home recording.
Take off your shoes, hang up your wings, stack up the chairs, roll up the rug. Savor the things that sobriety brings, draining the last from a jug. But when I hit the bottle, there's no telling what I'll do. There's something deep inside me wants to turn you black and blue. I can't resist you, I can't wait to twist your loving arms till you capitulate. Beat me.
It's Elvis Costello, a home recording from the 1970s, now released on the box set 2.5 Years. Did you perform a lot as a solo player when you were getting started, just you and your guitar?
Yeah, I mean, the first time I ever appeared in public, it was as a solo, you know, in a folk club. And I did a lot of that, both in London and in Liverpool. And I was also in a couple of bands, you know, but obviously semi-professional ones. And they changed in style from week to week as we kind of mastered things and as we learned things. And because when, you know, you're sort of 17, 18, 19, you're very impressionable of the things. You hear something, you immediately want to play like that, you know, and that mm-hmm. becomes the main thing you want to do. And then a little bit later, you sort of get a little confidence that actually there's this one style or a couple of styles that you feel that you have something special to offer to and start following those. So, you know, I had done a lot of those sort of things and So I'd had both experiences, really. But you know, I hadn't much experience of playing in rock and roll bands until I was in one really properly, you know.
My guest is Elvis Costello. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Elvis Costello, he's got a new album called Brutal Youth. How did you get your first guitar?
My first guitar, my mother's father bought me in Spain when I was very young. I think about 9, and I couldn't play it, and it was just a little, like a small Spanish guitar. And when I was about 13 or 14, I started to pick it up, and I even put steel strings on it, which, of course, immediately makes it go completely warped, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, I saved up my money and bought an acoustic, you know, like a folk singer's guitar, and just worked with that for some time. And then later on, you know, when I was a little older, when I was about 17, I got an electric guitar. That's about it, really. I mean, I with the band I was in when I first came to live in London, our drummer worked for a music store, and he was able to get discounts on guitars, but unfortunately, you just had to accept whichever model came from the factory, you know, and although
right.
all guitars are made on assembly lines these days, there are some differences between one and another, and in an ideal situation, you would try out the guitar. So my first serious electric guitar that I ever had was a Fender, which came in a cardboard box unopened from the factory, and I took it out, and the action, the relationship of the strings to the fretboard was worse than the cheap Japanese guitar I'd been playing for the previous 5 years.
Yeah.
But I didn't actually know you could change it, so I persevered with that guitar. In fact, I played it on half of the first album.
Are you kidding?
And somebody with the other guitar player that John McPhee played on that record looked at my guitar and said, "Why don't you adjust this? Because it must be so hard to play." And I didn't even know you could, because, like I say, I started with the folk guitar, and I never sat down and tried to work out Jimi Hendrix solos or anything like that,
right,
like a lot
right.
of my friends did. And it was just a tool, you know, that you could accompany yourself on. And an electric guitar was just like an acoustic guitar, except louder. And then I traded it in halfway through the first album sessions, because they were done in, like, you know, little sessions of 3 or 4 hours whenever I was, I could take days off my day job. And I traded it in for a Jazzmaster guitar, which is the one that's been the mainstay kind of guitar that I've used ever since.
I know your father sang in with bands. He was a band singer.
Yeah, with one band, really, most of the time.
When, which band was that?
It was the Joe Loss Orchestra.
So he sang, like, pop standards?
Well, I suppose when he started in the 50s, it would have been much more the typical big band ballad. But a lot of those bands kind of folded up in that time, obviously, as the guitar-based music took over more.
Yeah.
You know, that was death for really those big bands, which were obviously modelled on sort of like the Glenn Miller sound or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But Joe Loss and his arrangers were very, very shrewd, and they managed to kind of absorb a lot of the music. And my father is a very versatile singer, and they did the most unlikely covers. You know, they used to cover very contemporary pop records, and you know, they would do things like "See Emily Play" by Pink Floyd, you know, with these outlandish arrangements. I mean, I said to Dave Gilmore about that I had this. I know he didn't play on that record, but I told him this. I said, "I bet you any money the original Pink Floyd couldn't play See Emily Play live, because it's a very complex arrangement. It was a studio creation. And here I've got this tape of a radio broadcast from 1968 with my father singing it with this extraordinary band arrangement." It's very bizarre, you know, quite surreal.
Now, did you share musical taste with him, or did you rebel against his songs?
They both really love jazz, and singers such as Ella Fitzgerald and Sinatra and people like that. So I didn't really have any feeling of rebellion against that, because that was the music that was in the house when I was really little. And then, it obviously, like most people, you get to a certain age where you assert your own choice about music, and that happened to be right at a great period of English pop music, you know, with the Beatles and mm-hmm. all of that sort of stuff, which they also liked. I can't ever remember them not liking something that was good. I dare say my father had to sing sometimes a song that he didn't care for. And my mother, on the other hand, liked a lot of classical music and took me to concerts when I was little. So I got a little taste for that. So nothing really seemed like off limits or as if it didn't really belong to me or I was prejudiced against it.
When you started to sing, did your father think you had what it takes, or did he not take your voice seriously?
No, he was very encouraging. Both my parents were. I never let them come and see me, but...
You wouldn't let them come and see
not
you?
Not when I first started out, no.
Well, because you were... Why?
Well, I suppose you just wanted to learn how to do it first, and uh-huh. it was kind of embarrassing, but later on, they come to see me play now, and I can talk about the records with them that I make now.
Would it have been embarrassing early on to have your parents show up at a gig?
Oh, God, I think it would be for anybody, when you're sort of 16 or 17, And my son plays in a band now, and I went to see him play recently, but I had to creep in the back door in disguise.
That's funny, you having to sneak in through the back door. So how famous was your father when he was singing with the band?
Among a certain kind of clientele for that kind of dance music, they were pretty well known. I mean, they were one of the better known. Certainly the orchestra was very well known in the country.
Did changing your name have anything to do with wanting to be independent from your father's reputation?
Oh, no, not really. It wasn't like a Frank Sinatra Jr. situation.
Right,
he had had some success. They didn't do that many recordings, so that meant that the fame really revolved around the live performance in dance halls. There were a few recordings, and he did have one hit record in Germany under his own name, as opposed to a performance with the orchestra, not really. It wasn't there wasn't any problem about that.
Did he take it personally when you changed his name? Did he want you to?
No. Funnily enough, he had already used the same surname as an alias when doing a cover record. That he had done as a session singer, because he used to do some recording things under other names.
So he used Costello.
Yeah, because it's his grandmother's name.
So is that why you used it?
Yeah. Huh. No, I just plucked it out of the air.
Well, who knows? Who knows? And you used Elvis because of Presley, no doubt.
Well, it was my manager's idea. I think at the time, there were people with very, very obviously fake names, all the punk names.
Right.
And one certainly more enduring, I would say, better way to really, really make people sit up and take notice was to take the name, take a name that, like, in most people's minds, there could only ever be one of. I mean, really, it was a statement of saying, well, here's a singular person, and we didn't exactly debate the significance of it beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Let me just jump ahead to the present before we run out of time. Where are you living now? Are you in Ireland or
Ireland? We live in Dublin most of the time, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How do you like it there?
It's beautiful.
And are you as well known there as you would be in London?
It's difficult to say.
Does it get in your way?
No. Recently, I don't. It's a small place, and it's very easy to become like really omnipresent, And I don't really want that. It is a good place to live, where I feel like freer way to live, where I can work without interruption.
Elvis Costello recorded earlier this year. His latest CD is called Brutal Youth, and his box set reissue is called 2.5 Years. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We'll feature an interview with Nick Lowe in the second part of our show.
my spirit gets so downhearted sometimes. So where I strung and who I trusted, and where is the harmony, sweet harmony? 'Cause each time I feel it slip away, just makes me wanna cry. What's so fun about peace, love, and understanding? Oh, what's so fun about peace, love, and understanding?
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature an interview with songwriter, singer, bassist, and record producer Nick Lowe. Ever since the early 70s, Lowe's been shaping the sound of rock and roll. He helped create the British pub rock movement, produced artists as influential as Elvis Costello and the Pretenders, performed with Rockpile, and wrote lots of catchy songs. Also, some so-called world music records are getting on Milo Miles' nerves. He'll tell us why. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we have an interview with British songwriter, singer, bassist, and record producer Nick Lowe. In the 1970s, he helped move rock forward by getting it back in touch with its roots. As a member of the band Brinsley Schwartz, he was one of London's first pub rockers. As house producer for the new wave label Stiff, he produced the first albums by Elvis Costello and Graham Parker. In 1979, Lowe's own record, Cruel to Be Kind, made the American Top 20. He recorded several solo albums in the 70s and 80s. I spoke with him in 1990, after the release of his record Party of One. It was produced by guitarist Dave Edmonds, who used to play with Lowe in the band Rockpile. From Party of One, this is Nick Lowe's song All Men Are Liars. You in the early 70s played with Brinsley Schwartz, the British band, and you were one of the first groups to actually play the pubs, and this was like considered the roots of pub rock. Can you explain to Americans why it was such a big deal to be playing in pubs?
God, what a great question. You know, it's a really great question, because it's darn near impossible to explain why it was such a big deal. At that time, in England, England's a tiny place, you know, as anyone who goes there will testify. So everybody knows everybody else, you know, especially in the music business. And at that time, the big thing was glam rock then, which nobody who liked music really cared for. It's just a fashion thing. That's all England's contribution to the music scene has been for the last, I don't know, 20 years or so. But the pub rock thing was started, it's just playing, getting back to basics and playing in bars so anyone could just walk in. and get a bit of excitement going. But it's you know, you see it happening all the time in America, but in England it's kind of rare, you know. So that's why it's such a big deal, and so it's so difficult to explain what it, you know, to Americans why it was.
You were also the house producer for Stiff Records, which in the 1970s was one of the first real new wave labels. You produced Elvis Costello's first records. You produced Graham Parker's first record. What was your approach to producing it? I'm wondering if you felt that this was the start of something new, or if it just seemed like you know, business as usual to you.
Oh no! I was very reluctantly thrown into that, really. The only reason I got into producing was because of the three of us who started Stiff Records, which is myself, my manager Jake Riviera, and his pal Dave Robinson. I spent more time in the studio than the other two guys had, so I was automatically the house producer. I didn't really want the job, but that was, you know, I was designated that. But in fact, and I didn't know what I was doing, you know, at all. And in a way, that was why it worked, because the people that Stiff signed were all kind of oddballs, you know. So the fact that I didn't know what I was doing sort of only added added to the odd sound of those records. And I still don't, you know, I still don't know how to work the equipment or anything like that. But what I do is sort of wave my arms around you know, and tell a couple of jokes and things, and watch them do it, you know. And if with the engineers, if I get an engineer that I can talk to, you know, I don't say to him, "Hey man, put a bit of 3.4 on channel 26." You know, I don't know anything about that. I'll go more sort of, "Can you make it go a bit more, because it's just going zzz at the moment?" Or, you know, I go, "Can you make it go jang?" Or, "Can you make the drum go boing?" Or, you know, I make noises like that. And if they're cool, they know what I'm talking about. If they don't, then we're not going to get very far.
We're featuring a 1990 interview with Nick Lowe. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is British songwriter, singer, bass player, and record producer Nick Lowe. Now, I want to play one of your songs that it's a great song. It's "What's So Funny About Peace and Peace, Love, and Understanding." I'd like to hear the story behind the song, if there is one, and how ironic or how serious you were about the meaning of the lyrics.
Let me see. I thought this song up in about 1973. It's quite an old song, and when I did it as a joke, really. It's so sort of pretentious, you know. I did it on purpose. This sort of, "As I walk this wicked world, searching, you know, for this and that and the other." I thought it was kind of funny, you know, and then finish off with "What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding" is the hook, and it was okay, you know, it was pretty good. But then Elvis Costello started doing it in, I don't know, the late 70s or early 80s. And he started doing it in his show, and he still does it. And I don't know, he put something into the words, into the performance of it, that made the words, even though I meant them as a joke, you know, it made them mean something, you know. And the song's sort of, I've changed my mind about the song. I think it's really pretty good now.
So do you sing it more seriously now when you do it yourself?
I think so, yeah. I think I do too, yeah. Maybe because I'm older or something like that, you know. I don't feel quite that it's quite such a joke or something, you know. But it's still, look, it's still not as good as Jailhouse Rock.
Well, let's hear Nick Lowe's recording of "What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding."
Thank you.
Nick Lowe recorded in 1974 with the band Brinsley Schwartz. How did you start writing songs?
When I left home with a guitar case in my hand, Lord, which was in 1968, you had to write your own songs. That was the thing to do. You know, every group. You wouldn't get anywhere unless you had somebody in the group who could write their own songs.
This is the post-Beatle years.
Yeah, that's right. And so there was a lot of really crappy songs about. And I was sort of designated the songwriter of the group. And my initial efforts, you know, it takes a while for you to find your own style. So my initial efforts were really derivative. You know, I mean, I really can't listen to the first records that I did. When you start off, you have this preconceived idea of what you are. You know, I mean, I thought I was this sort of bad dude from the swamps, you know, which I'm patently I'm not. You know, I'm a white middle class English kid, you know, or was a kid, you know. But and once you accept that, then you can get on with it. You know, once you accept what you are, then you get your own style going, and you can relax about it.
When you started, as you say, accepting who you were. Did the kinds of songs you were writing change?
No, I don't think so. I've been singing the same song basically since I started. You know, when I was a real kid, the nearest you could get to rock and roll on Forces Radio, because my dad was in the Royal Air Force, and so I lived wherever he was stationed. You know, which is mainly in the Middle East. And so I used to listen to Forces Radio, and at that time in the '50s, you know, it was very very. You know, it was all Rosemary Clooney and
Perry Como.
Perry Como and that, yes. Which, as a matter of fact, the first record I bought was Magic Moments by Perry Como. I thought that was absolutely fantastic. Still do, as a matter of fact. I still think that's wild. But the nearest you could get to any kind of rock and roll stuff was a fellow called Lonnie Donegan. And he used to do... he had this sound, he used to call this skiffle sound, which was, you know, heavy, just thumping acoustic guitars and a real simple bass and drum line. And washboards, this place washboard thing, you know.
Now I think there's a couple of hits that Americans would remember, like "Does Your Chewing Gum Lose Its Flavor on the Bedpost Overnight," which I think is really just an atrocious record.
Yeah, yes, that was a bit later on. Extremely amusing to English people, but totally. Was that a hit over here, really?
Yeah.
Good grief. No, that was awful. But his early stuff was really great.
Nick Lowe is my guest. You know how you said that you're still writing the same song and these are mm-hmm. songs influenced by the Lonnie Donegan days?
Yeah.
Choose a song on the new record that you think is obviously influenced by that.
By Lonnie Donegan?
By the early stuff that you're listening to there.
Oh, I think most of it is actually on the new record, but an obvious example would be Who Was That Man?
Mm-hmm. Actually, you know what song I hear in that?
What?
You know Children Go Where I Send Thee? You know?
Wait a minute, I think I do, yeah. It's a sort of a spiritual thing,
exactly,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Well, that's quite unconscious.
Uh-huh.
Quite unconscious, but great.
Okay.
That's not a bad place to get something from.
So let's listen to Who Was That Man?
Who was that? Who was that man? Nobody knows all across this land. Was that an unknown man? Who was that? Who was that man? It was a wild and wet November night, and the rush hour was at its height. Kings crossed the venue that the finger of death was pointed at. Among the crowd was a lonely soul with a mission.
passion in mind and a place to go. Nobody knows where he was bound when his fateful steps took him underground. Who was that? Who was that man? Nobody loved him all across this land. Who was that? An unloved man. Who was that? Who was that man?
Is this record more of a return to folk in your musical background than previous records have been?
I don't think so. I think doing touring with Elvis Costello, mm-hmm. he encouraged me to go on tour with him playing acoustically, you know. And I didn't think I could do it, but he really kind of bullied me into it, you know. And I'm really glad he did, because If you stand up on the stage with an acoustic guitar in front of a few people, you soon can tell, you know, if your stuff is happening or not. And it put me back in touch with my own songwriting thing, which I'd lost sight of a little bit. And if folk music means something that you can just rip off on a guitar, then yes. But the thing is that I was listening to some of my old records to try and get an act together, you know, trying to think, well, which one shall I do in this act? I had to relearn them again. You know, I couldn't remember how they went. I found that some of the best records I'd made were some of the worst songs, like I Love the Sound of Breaking Glass, for instance, is a record of nothing very much. It's a good record, but there's nothing very much there in a song-wise, you know. Whereas a song like Raining, I listened to that and went, oh, man, you just recorded this all wrong. You know, the song isn't there, you know, the way it's been recorded. In other words, you can record a song or make a record. Do you see that there's a subtle difference there?
Oh, sure. There's a lot of records that are really great records because of the way they're produced, because of the way the singer sounds, but the song is pretty insubstantial. It's not one you'd want to pick at yourself. Yeah.
Like Let Me Take You to Funky Town by Lip Sync. You know, that was a really great record, that was, but there's not very much
right.
of a song there.
Right. One of your American releases has a great title, Pure Pop for Now People. And what is the meaning of pop to you? How has that word changed to you over the years?
Well, popular music is stuff that sells, you know, which patently mine doesn't. You know, the stuff I do is still kind of a secret in the great scheme of things. But the stuff I suppose what I'm known for being a sort of pop guy is because I'm a fan, you know, really, and I sort of imitate the. Or at that time, anyway, I was sort of imitating what people's perception of pop music was, which is like, you know, real throwaway fluff, you know, just rejoicing in its disposability, you know. It always reminds me of sort of like cornflakes ads, you know, jingles on the TV, you know, real disposable stuff. And I like that.
Nick Lowe recorded in 1990. This is Fresh Air. World music commentator Milo Miles generally likes to emphasize the positive in his reviews, but lately he's been compiling a list of gripes. There are some unpleasant confusions, sad trends, and hit songs that just bug him lately.
This is Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered. Coming up on today's program, we'll be hearing about a new health reform proposal worked out by 7 members, Republicans and Democrats, of the Senate Finance Committee. They call it a mainstream, a moderate proposal. We'll hear about that and also speak with one of its architects, Senator John Breaux, Democrat of Louisiana. Also on today's program, Noah Adams with a special report on the legacy of Stonewall, a moment that changed the lives of many gay and lesbian Americans. Also, news of leaks from the O.J. Simpson case, how they happened, what impact they might have on his trial, the Supreme Court, and more efforts to support the dollar. All that coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
It seems to me that before you complain, you should confess. And I confess I have no more perfect definition of world music than anyone else. but I do think the term should have an identity that sets it apart from other kinds of music. World music insiders point to Angelique Kidjo from Benin as a potential superstar. She's very ambitious and is willing to do whatever it takes to get the word out about herself. Her extrovert enthusiasm is contagious, and she really knows how to work a crowd in her red-hot live shows. Like many before, she started to dilute her sound into trendy styles. Her hook is still that she's a world music performer, but I'm sorry. Her new single, Agolo, is nothing more than a routine house number sung in a foreign language with a few exotic rhythm touches. Even if Kidjo's watered-down tunes do make her famous, it would be not much of a world music breakthrough. Another distortion of world music is the kind of universal tune that comes from everywhere and nowhere. This problem affects a song that's already a hit, Sweet Lullaby by Deep Forest. The moody, kaleidoscopic video makes excellent eye candy, and here's a bite of the sound. The buzz on Deep Forest and Sweet Lullaby is that its combination of ambient dance beats and sampled pygmy vocals makes some sort of nifty statement about preserving ecological systems. But the pygmy vocals are strictly exotic sprinkles and no more a triumph for pygmy music than Martin Denny was a triumph for Polynesian music. Deep Forest is not quite as pompous as the group Enigma, but they both wear the same stuffed European shirts. Now I have another final confession about reggae cover tunes. I wrote a piece defending UB40's cover of Can't Help Falling in Love. I still swear it's not bad for a band so deserving of success and who have written such sharp protest tunes. Go ahead, as Sonny Bono would say, laugh at me. I had no idea Can't Help Falling in Love would start a trend of mellow reggae covers springing to the top of the charts from movie soundtracks. So now we have the group Big Mountain, with acres of the most affected dreadlocks you ever saw, and their version of Baby I Love Your Way is out of the Reality Bites soundtrack and all over MTV. I will say this, the heavy dance remix is tolerable, just barely. But the wretched regular version is a top 10 hit. UB40 was one thing, but this band doing a Peter Frampton song? Oh.
Every day, yeah, yeah. Ooh, baby, I love your way. Every day. Shadows grow so long before my eyes, and they're moving across the page.
Boycott wimpy reggae covers before they spread any further.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. Fresh Air is directed by Roberta Chirac. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross. Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, how to do a dialect or how to lose one. We talk with speech therapist Sam Schwat. He helped actor Robert De Niro lose his Brooklyn accent and take on an Appalachian one for the movie Cape Fear. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.